The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Garrison Keillor, author, musician, humorist, although he calls himself a satirist, columnist, and so much more. He's probably most well-known for Prairie Home Companion and as the host and writer of that broadcast, which has just had its 35th anniversary this past Wednesday. Yesterday. Sorry. 35 years. It's kind of scary. Each week, more than 4 million listeners tune in to 580 public radio stations across the country to listen to this variety show, which features music, comedy skits, and most importantly, Keillor's own weekly news from Lake Wobegon, a monologue that covers the small-town happenings of his fictitious hometown. I think we all know people who live there. I think we can all picture, at least my children are there as the above average. Liberty, his newest release, also takes place in Lake Wobegon and is the follow-up to the New York Times bestseller, Pontoon. Keillor is the author of more than a dozen books for children and adults, including A Homegrown Democrat, A Few Plain Thoughts from the Heart of America. He truly is a jack of all trades, having contributed to Salon.com, The New Yorker, and Atlantic Monthly. I think the New York Times summed up his tried and true style most succinctly when it said, "Only the most skillful literary hand should attempt the combination of flat-out farce and genuine emotion." And Keillor is up to the job. We are honored to have him with us here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Garrison Keillor.
That needs to be turned on, of course. As anyone would know who had ever worked with microphones for even 5 minutes, I've hired somebody to turn my microphone on for me back in St. Paul, and I want to start out by reciting you some sonnets. You may not have heard any yet today. And they're not in this book, which supposedly I'm here to promote. I don't think that sonnets ever could be promoted. But as I get older and life seems messier and more confusing to me, sonnets come to mean more and more to me. I wrote a sonnet that should be sung. It's a prayer. Here I am, O Lord, and here is my prayer. Please be there. Don't want to ask too much, miracles and such. Just whisper in the air, please be there. When I die like other folks, don't want to find out you're a hoax. So I'm not on my knees asking for world peace, or that the polar ice cap freeze and save the polar bear, or even that the poor be fed, or angels hover o'er my bed. But I would sure be pissed if I should have been an atheist. Oh, Lord, please exist. Whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa, 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 whoa. Oh, I'm a radio man for 35 years doing an old variety show stolen from some I used to hear when I was your age long ago. Critics pointed out my debts to Bob and Ray and Gary Moore, but alcohol and cigarettes threw those critics out the door. and to 20-year-olds who were born too late to hear the great Fred Allen. I'm the inventor of the form, sailing the airwaves like Magellan. A thief who escapes and is not hung may yet be honored by the young. Ooh, whoa, 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 whoa. I love to sing, whoa, whoa, whoa. Whoa, 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 all English majors do. La, 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 la. The papers report bad news everywhere. Hurricanes, enormous banks sliding headfirst toward oblivion at 15 cents a share. And going south, the bubble has burst. And that castle that we built in the air is likely to fall. And don't worry, mon cher, although I'm sure our pension fund is cursed. But if we should have to go on welfare and wear used clothes and live on angel hair and liverwurst, still we have this lovely love affair in which we seem to be immersed. And I would love to see you there, swimming in the creek behind our shack. I'll love you still and hope you love me back. Oh, 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 oh. You made crusty bread rolls filled with chunks of brie and minced garlic drizzled with olive oil and baked them until the brie was bubbly and we ate them lovingly, our legs coiled together under the table, and salmon and dill with lemon and whole wheat couscous. Baked with fresh ginger and garlic and a hill of green beans and carrots roasted with honey and tofu. It was beautiful, the candles, the linen, the silver, the sun shining down on our northern street. Me with my hand on your leg, you, my lover, in your jeans and green t-shirt and your beautiful bare feet. How simple life is. We buy a fish, we are fed. We sit close to each other. We talk and then we go to bed. Whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa, 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 whoa. You're wondering how many do I know? Whoa, whoa, whoa. Whoa, 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 whoa. A lot, a whole lot. Whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa, 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 whoa. Up in the sky, the lovers lay in bed, naked face to face and hip to thigh, her leg between his arm beneath her head, their hands roaming freely up in the sky. In the dark, Philadelphia lay at their feet like a blanket of glittering stars thrown down. Beyond her bare shoulder was Market Street, and from her left ankle the buses headed uptown. They came to the city for romance, as people do, and with each other they scaled the heights. And now, united at rest, they lie, these two, the bed rocking gently in a sea of lights. Where do they go? What happens next? I do not know. I am that man standing at the bus stop far below. Whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa, whoa. Bryn Mawr girl in the plaid skirt and the sweater set, working at the New Yorker in the summer of 69, reading unsolicited stories and smoking a cigarette. Thank you, my darling, for rescuing mine. You gave it your blessing in the form of a green slip, telling the editor to read it, and he read it. And your gift of attention launched my little ship off in the direction in which it still is headed. Years have passed since you looked at me and saved me from a life of drudgery, my sweet. I bless your unknown name for the gift you gave, my darling angel of 25 West 43rd Street. I have done some good work, Lord knows I have tried, and yet the importance of angels cannot be denied. Oh, 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 oh. The secret of a long career is to keep going and never fade, and not think about your reputation even for 1 minute. It's like becoming the tallest boy in the sixth grade. You stick around and you're bound to win it. Fyodor Dostoevsky over time found a punishment to fit the crime. And slowly as a centipede trots off, he wrote the Brothers Karamazov. Mrs. Joyce cried out in bliss, he's finally done it, he's finished Ulysses. James had a smoke and took a break and started in on Finnegan's Wake. So do your work, keep going straight ahead, and you may be a genius someday after you are dead. Whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa, whoa, one more. Whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa, whoa. Georges Bizet was born in Omaha, Lutheran bred. His name was Duane. He was in 4-H. He got a blue ribbon for building a pig shed, but he felt he was different from an early age. He walked around town in a black beret. Something French in him needed to be expressed, he felt, and one fine printemps day in May, he said to his mom, "Mama, I must leave the Midwest." She said, "Duane, it would break our hearts if you leave." He said, "Mama, I'm not cut out for farming. My je ne sais quoi is joie de vivre." And that night he said to his girlfriend Carmen, "It's cold here, darling, and the water tastes like copper. A plane leaves for Paris at 12. Let's go and be an opera." Whoa, 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 whoa. I was lying one more. Whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa. You lay your head on my arm, and your eyes close, and your breath gets slow, and your sweet lips open where we lie on the bed crosswise. A streetcar rockets past in the dark street. You are so beautiful, the candle flickers on the shelf, the clock ticks, the neighbors have gone to bed. The city sleeps. I have you all to myself. I am the lonely guardian of your lovely head. I pray that ice will never touch your heart, that you will thrive and bloom like the apple tree, and rise up singing when we part, and when you are old, have some fond thoughts of me. Good night, my love, you of all the loveliest. The angels smile and watch you as you rest. Ooh, 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 ooh. Those are some sonnets that I have been writing lately. I've gone back to what my teachers back in junior high school tried to impress on me, the beauty of form, of 14 lines, A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G. And it is a beautiful thing, the sonnet. It's an amazing thing. I recommend it to you, whether you are an English major or not. Anyone who is important to you in your life would be absolutely astounded if you wrote her or him a sonnet. There's nothing more wonderful. None of those sonnets were written for real people, or if they were, I would not tell you. But it's something that I've come across late in life, writing that you do only for yourself. It has no outcome, really. It has some very slight currency in the world. It has no commercial value. Nobody will ever pay you to write sonnets. This makes it all the more compelling to me. And I realize as I write them that I am returning to something that goes back a long time for me, that I was brought up with, was a very simple love of the use of language on the part of my people who were not well-to-do people at all. They were dirt farmers in Minnesota. I sat my little town of Lake Wobegon down where they settled. They were not Norwegian. I've lied about that, but they were Scots, English people, and they came over to this country without much at all, except a dream, which turned out not to be true, and they settled down there on rolling sandy land that was not good for much at all. The Norwegians got all the good land off in western Minnesota, the Red River Valley, which is some of the most fertile land on God's green earth, and my people were there in sort of rocky dairy farming country. But they never really earn much at all. They just raised children out there, and they lived a life of faith. They were fundamentalist people who didn't have much fun with fundamentalism, but they looked forward to a life to come in which all of this would be resolved. I spent many summers on my grandmother's farm, and it was. It was memorable. It was memorable. It was rolling sandy country, as I say, and there were chickens wandering in the yard and a couple of geese. And as a child, you learned the meaning of the verb goose. You learned it from geese. And you got up in the morning and you took your chamber pot out from under your bed, which was a hard bed, and you emptied it in the outhouse, and you washed it out in the pump in the yard, and then you washed your face in cold water from the pump with lava soap to stimulate the circulation, and you came into a kitchen that smelled of kerosene and smelled of wood smoke and ash, and you had breakfast of flapjacks. My grandmother was a lovely woman in a cotton print dress who stood at a sink, and the water was boiling in a tea kettle on the wood stove, and she was washing the dishes, and she sang hymns. My people loved hymns, and they loved poetic hymns. They would never have thrived in the praise churches of today, where 6,000 people get together in a basketball arena and they sing a hymn off a PowerPoint, and they're all bouncing around with their hands up in the air, and they sing these 7-11 hymns, what we call, you sing 7 words 11 times, and there are people with handheld microphones who are bouncing around and urging you to smile and be joyful in the Lord. My people were not a joyful people. Life was suffering. This was the meaning of life, was suffering. And if it should seem easy or pleasant, you're probably in the wrong place. And be patient. This will pass. Eventually, life is a life of tribulation, and we deal with it according to the dictates of our faith, and we look forward to the time when the trumpet will sound, and we will rise. Those who believe in Him will rise through the air, and join the Lord in the air, and go off to a land of eternal youth and eternal happiness, and eternal summer, which meant a lot to us in Minnesota. Where summer is very, very brief and has its own tribulations, deer flies and horse flies that make a mark on you that you will carry to your grave, and those pock marks in people's faces, that's not smallpox, that's for flies biting you, and mosquitoes, enormous mosquitoes in Minnesota, because the winter kills off all of the lesser species, and these enormous mosquitoes are left that are like fruit bats. Actually, they're enormous. You hold one in your hand, so that's why people in Minnesota are so pale. Just through steady blood loss. Bug repellent has no effect on them whatsoever. It only irritates them. A crucifix helps, but you have to hit them really hard before they go down. But the hymns that I grew up with were ornate and beautiful hymns, and they were poems, and we were meant to memorize them. We believe that what you took into your memory was thereby part of your heart, you see. And if you were simply reading something off a page, it didn't mean as much as if you took it into your heart, and my grandmother knew all of these because her hands were busy as she was washing dishes, and she would sing these gorgeous hymns that we never sing in the Episcopal Church. Never hear them at all. How tasteless and tedious the hours when Jesus no longer I see. Sweet prospects, sweet birds, and sweet flowers have all lost their sweetness to me. The midsummer sun shines but dim. The fields strive in vain to look gay. But when I am happy in Him, December's as pleasant as May. His name yields the sweetest perfume, and sweeter than music His voice. His presence disperses my gloom, and makes all sure within me rejoice. I would were he always thus nigh, have nothing to want or to fear. No happier pilgrim than I, my summer would last all the year. And in these hymns you found beautiful words like disperses my gloom and pilgrim. You picked up all these words as a little fundamentalist kid that you held in your heart and you treasured. Some you don't often get to use in everyday English, propitiation, for example, but my people loved, you see, they loved these hymns for the poetry of them as much as anything else. I'm telling you that. That's not what they would tell you. they would tell you that they loved them for the meaning of them and for what they expressed about Jesus and their love of Jesus. But I think that there was a love of language here, and that's what I picked up from this. Was their love of language and the cadence of the King James Bible. I know whom I have believed and am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I've committed unto him against that day. They loved to read aloud from it. After we finished eating our flapjacks, we would go into the front room of my grandmother's house, and my Uncle Jim would come over, and my Aunt Elizabeth, and sometimes other relatives who lived nearby, and we would read from Scripture, and not the comforting parts, certainly not the story of the prodigal son. That was nothing they put a lot of weight on. They believed in forgiveness in theory, but, you know, you shouldn't count on animals being killed, you know, in your behalf. We read from the Old Testament. We read a lot from Leviticus and the books of Kings and the books of Samuel, and back when God was working his will by whacking people. They liked those. They loved the word abomination. Abomination. You don't learn that nowadays in the schools. The word abomination, but we picked it up from Scripture. I mean, God was whacking those Midianites. God was smiting people, so they stayed smitten, and they loved those stories. And then we would kneel down for prayer, and prayer was an extensive experience. A lot was brought up before the Lord in prayer, including certain people by name. And we would kneel on a wood floor, and there was a sofa there that had been in our family for generations, and we would put our faces down into the cushions of the sofa where our ancestors had sat for many years, and where we were reminded that they had been farmers and they had worked with large animals. So that was prayer to me. But through it all was this love of language and this love of poetry. Come thou fount of every blessing, teach my heart to sing thy praise. Streams of mercy never ceasing, call for songs of loudest praise. Teach me some melodious sonnet, sung by flaming tongues above. Here's the mount, oh, fix me on it, mount of thy redeeming love. Now to grace, how great a debtor, daily I'm constrained to be. Let thy goodness, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it, prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it with thy boundless love's language that a child was mystified by and fascinated by. Teach me some melodious sonnet. What does that mean? It was beautiful imagistic verse, and they adored these hymns, and so did I. They were not a prudish people. They were not without humor. This is a misapprehension about fundamentalists. Fundamentalists were a closed society. They believed in absolute separation from the world. But once you close yourself off from the world, within your group, there's great affection. A kind of a staunch affection, but there also is an occasional outburst of comedy. They loved jokes about scripture. They loved jokes about animals, about bodily functions. They were country people. They were not a prudish or fastidious people. They loved jokes. The farmer had a champion bull, bred 200 times a year. The farmer's wife said, 200 times? That's remarkable, dear. Maybe you ought to watch him. Maybe he'd show you how. The farmer said he's a champion bull, but it wasn't just with one cow. They loved suggestive humor and double entendres. I mean, not in all company, but in safe company, they loved suggestive jokes. When God created woman, he gave her not two breasts but three, but the middle one got in the way, so God performed surgery. Woman came before God with the middle breast in her hand. She said, "What shall we do with the useless boob?" And God created man. I love jokes that touched on scripture and that connected scripture to everyday life. That was really the basis of their comedy, such as it was to draw a connection between the sacred and the ordinary, the profane, I guess one would say. The devil came to church one day in a burst of smoke and flame. He ran up and down the aisles. He said, "Beelzebub is my name. I am evil incarnate, the object of all your fears." The old man said, "You don't scare me at all. I've been married to your sister for 38 years. Well, they lived a life of faith, which, as I look back on it, seems to me to be absolutely profound, but which at the time seemed to me to be a sort of penal colony of piety, and so I was anxious to escape from it. To me, winter and fundamentalism just went hand in hand as two similar forms of oppression. Winter in Minnesota is an experience. I'm sorry if you've escaped it. After you've been through it, everything else is easy. The rest of life is no problem whatsoever. Of course, it was worse when I was a child. It was just absolutely ferocious, and blizzards rolling in, starting around Columbus Day, and one after the other. Just no windbreak, no weather forecasting back then. We just didn't have radar. We just had elderly people who sat in the chimney corner, you know, wrapped in old dirty quilts, and their old roomy eyes looking up towards the ceiling and listening to the wind in the chimney, and chicken grease dribbling down their old grizzled chins, and forecasting disaster, which they did. That was all they knew, was to forecast disaster. And, you know, often enough they were right. We lived in a low thermostat home. My father was a frugal man, and he believed that if you couldn't see your breath when you talked, then the furnace was turned up too high. Not that we talked, we didn't, but we didn't talk because we knew what the others thought, you know, so what was there to talk about? And but we respirated, and you see your breath, and you go up to bed at night and crawl in, and you're sometimes in all of your clothing, which is so cold upstairs, and there's just no thought of bedwetting whatsoever. Just never even considered that. You just went off to school, and school was never canceled. I mean, you don't. Once you start canceling school in Minnesota, where would you stop? So you go to school, and you learn that some words sound the same and are spelled differently, and the benefit of schooling. But in school, we met our teachers who were subversive people. Their task was not to pass on our parents' view of the world, but to pass on an alternative view, a sort of a classic view. And the love of language, the love of story, the love of jokes. Jokes are like poems. They're just perfect little constructions of language. You put an extra unnecessary word into a joke and it just throws it off and it just falls over. The love of language is picked up by the school that your parents inculcated in you and takes you off in directions that your parents could not have estimated. This is an amazing thing that happens to almost everybody, is the effect of books and schools on impressionable minds. We believe in this in our society. It's right to bring this up sitting in the auditorium of a public library. In the end, despite all of its dangers, we believe in freedom. We believe in the freedom of the mind. And we grant this freedom to our children, even though it makes us quake inwardly. And we're terrified. And we're already terrified. The life of parents is a life of paranoia and constant prayer. So what my teachers did was to take this love of language and to take it off in the direction of poetry, the Elizabethans. The basis of our poetry is all back there in the time of Shakespeare. And it was a time when life expectancy was very low. 35, 40, 45 years. No need for dental work, actually. I mean, just by the time your teeth were rotting, so were you. And so they wrote these urgent poems about the need to take hold of life because it is so brief. Summer, the metaphor for the brevity of life, to Thomas Campion and to Spencer and to Shakespeare and to Waller and to Harrick, Robert Harrick. Oh, daffodils, we weep to see you haste away so soon, as yet the early morning sun had not attained its noon. So gather rosebuds while ye may, for time is still a-flying, and this same flower that smiles today, tomorrow will be dying. Made a big impression on me when I was a kid. I loved these poems. Come live with me and be my love, and we will all the pleasures prove that this brief summer yields, and we will sit upon the rocks by shallow waterfalls and listen to melodious flocks of birds sing madrigals, wrote Christopher Marlowe, trying to persuade some young woman to go to bed with him, I suppose. I wasn't thinking of that when I read it, come live with me and be my love, and we will all the pleasures prove. I had no idea what pleasures referred to there, but it meant something to me, and it was so different. This was not what the sanctified brethren had in mind, proving all of the pleasures. This was not what this life was about. This was another view of the world that our teachers handed down to us. Wordsworth and his intimations of immortality, which is all about this life, is not about the life to come. There was a time when grove and stream and every common sight had all the freshness of a dream and radiance so bright, though nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, the loveliness of summer flower, its glory soon is past. The message of all of these great poets that I remember from when I was a kid was, grab hold of this life. Every day is a gift. Every moment, every part of it. Don't waste your time in regret and remorse. My people believed in remorse. They lived by it. Grab hold of this day. Wine, it comes in at the mouth, and love comes at the eye. That is all we know of truth, for we grow old and die. I lift the glass up to my mouth, I look at you and sigh. My people loved songs and stories about death rather than love. It just seemed more truthful to them, I suppose. I was put to sleep for years by my mother or my grandmother or my Aunt Eva singing a song to me about the death of small children in the snow. Which, to me, just seemed normal at the time. But now, as I look back on it, it seems weird. You know, you're lying there in bed, you can see your breath, and she's singing, "My friends, have you heard how a long time ago two little children, whose names I don't know, were stolen away on a cold winter day and left in the woods," I've heard people say. And about the time it got to the third verse, where they were dead, and the robins brought strawberry leaves and over them spread, that's when you went to sleep. You dozed off, and you had mortality on your mind. The songs that they sang that were not about Jesus or about the cross or about the sacrifice of blood were songs about death and sometimes the death of bad men, bandits, and so forth, and murder ballads. They had a certain taste for these things. I don't know where they got them. They were handed down from from somebody, from somewhere. Rise up on your bed of straw and see if you can't pull back your bow one more time. You're sick from your wounds and you think that you don't care, but you know it would prey on your mind. And wherever your arrow falls to the ground, we'll lay Lonesome Robin down one last time. No more, Robin, no more, your outlaw days are over. When you were a little boy, you had to go to bed when the sun still shone, and it was like sleep was the end of the world, and tomorrow would never come. Hold on to whatever is closest to you. That's all Lonesome Robin can do one last time. No more, Robin, no more, your outlaw days are over. Now, when you're offered a choice between ballads about death and songs about love, and you are 14, 15 years old, you do prefer songs about love. Even though you have a morbid imagination, nonetheless, you like to imagine that something else is possible for you. I was hardly a romantic figure when I was 14 years old and used to hang out in libraries as much as possible. I was almost 6 feet tall. I weighed about 128 pounds. I wore hand-me-down clothes. I wore the half-rim glasses, those half-rim with brown plastic tops, and the home haircut, and that mark of shame, that big high arc that was shaved up high over your ears, which said that your family was too poor to send you to a barber, and so your father had to cut your hair, and it also said that he didn't want to have to do it again anytime soon. And so there you were. You had this weird hair, and your wrists stuck out of your cuffs, and you had high water pants and great big shoes, and your hand-me-down clothes mostly came from your older brother, but some from your older sister. And there was a shirt that you were made to wear that had some embroidery on it, and it had darts. And you had a pair of jeans that zipped up the side. So when you walked down the hall in school, you had to hold your books in a strategic way and make your way. But in the library, nobody looked at you. The library was a place where you were safe from comparisons. And you could live in your own head, which was where I loved to live when I was 14, and to live inside books. Well, I escaped from them, I thought, at the time. I got as far away as I could through poems and through Marlowe and Shakespeare and then through Elvis and Jerry Lee and Little Richard, listening to rock and roll music, which was forbidden to us because it was dance music. My parents referred to it as fornicating music, which one could only hope was true, but hard to tell at that age, and when it's that cold out, you know, where would you go? or listening to the radio under the covers up in a cold bedroom, and you can see your breath, and you take your radio under the covers so your parents won't hear you. And it's not a transistor radio. This is in the day of vacuum tubes, which gave off heat, and so you'd lie under the covers, and you'd be perspiring heavily as you listen to music coming from the South, from people you could hardly even imagine, and Jerry Lee at the piano. You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. Too much love drives a man insane. You broke my will, but what a thrill. Goodness gracious, great balls of fire. I looked at love and I thought it was funny. You came along and you moved me, honey. I changed my mind. This love is fine. Goodness gracious. Kiss me, baby. Feels good. Hold me, baby. I want to love you like a lover should. So fine, so fine. Want to tell the world that you're mine, mine, mine. We were forbidden to dance, or even move in a rhythmic manner. For fear that it would awaken our carnal impulses. Though they were, of course, fully awake. Dressed and waiting for the bus to come. But so here you had come, full almost a half circle away from the life of discipline and self-deprivation that your parents had brought you up to expect, and you had come into full American adolescence, which is the expectation of romance, the expectation of a beautiful life here on this earth, here and now, and to be rewarded with the love of another person. This is a long way to come, but it's the route there is all through the love of language as much as it is hormones or chemistry. The love of language, which makes you fascinated by poems, songs, stories. We grew up with the stories of Scripture, of course. Noah and the people knock, knock, knocking on the ark, you know, as the rain is coming down, and that's a very serious story for children. Daniel in the lion's den, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Jonah being swallowed by the whale. Interesting story, but we were inland people, so it just didn't seem to apply to us. Abraham taking Isaac up to the mountaintop with a knife ready to sacrifice his son if the Lord should give the word. A weird story, but, you know, we come from a prairie state, so it's not, didn't seem to, you know, be pertinent to us. Same with Moses in the bulrushes and all. But we grew up with this love of stories, which then continues on as you develop material for your own stories. And your own stories depend a good deal on your having transgressed. A person who has led a life of discipline and rectitude and order in his or her own life hardly has the wherewithal to tell a good story. You discover this at some point, that the license for storytelling is found in the epistle of St. James, where it says, "Brethren, confess ye your sins to one another." And I've done this with the Lake Wobegon stories. Now, the Lake Wobegon stories started out 35 years ago as my way of making fun of my parents, the Sanctified Brethren, the Lutherans I grew up among, and all of them. They were purely, I wouldn't even dignify them by calling them satiric. They were just sarcastic, that's all. And they found a certain audience, but over time they moved in a glacial way towards stories that had affection for their characters. And when you are able to be satiric with people for whom you have affection, you have crossed a bridge into something that is worth more, I think, and of greater value, and which offers you more freedom as a storyteller to be able to range from the borders of sentimentality off into satire. I told a story yesterday on the show about a great urge on the part of people from Lake Wobegon to make a new start, to have a second chance late in life. This late burst toward romance could have gone much farther, could have told much more than I did. It was about apple pie and salad and soup at the Chatterbox Cafe, but one could have gone on from that. But this has been a theme in some of my work, and oftentimes this involves transgression on the part of people from Lake Wobegon. If listeners imagine that this is a program of inspirational stories about small town values, they're just wrong. They're just wrong. Small towns are more interesting than that. And I've been telling these stories for years. So if people are shocked by this book, in which there is adultery and so forth, I have told these stories before. I'm sorry, I have. The story of Mr. Kruger, who was at the grain elevator. He worked at the grain elevator. He was kind of a scrawny, sawed off guy who smelled of cornmeal and had an odd haircut and half rimmed glasses fixed with black grip tape and his pants hitched up high over his waist. And yet, unlikely as it may have seemed, he conceived a great romance for his daughter's 11th grade English teacher, Miss Fleischman, and went in to have a parent-teacher conference on a fall night years ago over a poem that the teacher had assigned Carolyn to write about. Since feeling is first, who pays any attention to the syntax of things will never wholly kiss you, wholly to be a fool. While spring is in the world, my blood approves, and kisses are a better fate than wisdom. Lady, I swear, by all flowers. They talked about this poem for a while, and they must have given some signal to each other, because the conference adjourned after the sun went down to the Moonlight Bay Supper Club, and they had a bombardier there, which is a drink you should avoid if you are going to operate heavy machinery or if you want to keep control of yourself. And they went off to his pickup truck, and they parked in it on that stretch of gravel road, which is north of town. The state highway swings off to the west, and the gravel goes straight on. And they sat in there, and they steamed up the windows for a time in an old pickup truck that did not have bucket seats but a bench seat in the front, and they sat in there, never imagining that big lumber truck would come barreling up the state highway and not see that turn and just go straight on up the gravel and sideswipe that pickup truck. That was literally the last thing that Mr. Kruger had on his mind. She suffered cuts and contusions and shock, I suppose, and guilt, I suppose, but walked away, and his naked body was thrown out onto the gravel where it lay there in the gleam of the sheriff's headlights. And what he had been doing in the truck was clear if you took a close look at his body. That's what that was. That was something he put on for safety, and it had not worked in his case. You assumed they removed it at the mortuary, but... So he had to be, the funeral had to be held out of the Lutheran church, but Pastor Tomerdahl preached a stiff sermon, and he preached on the scripture text, "Be sure your sin will find you out." You cannot be secret in this life. Your sin will be known to other people. And he bore in on this point until his secretary started sobbing. So, that story came out, and then he had to be fired. And the church board that voted to dismiss him... The chairman of the church board, Eugene, voted for dismissal, even as he was thinking to himself, I suppose, thank goodness I destroyed all those letters from Sheila that I did. But there was one letter he had not destroyed, and he couldn't bear to give it up. It was a letter from Sheila on scented stationery, saying what a fabulous lover he was, and how strong, and how generous, and how patient, and how imaginative he was, and how thrilling he was. He could not bear to give up this letter of recommendation. He put it in a place he thought it would be safe. He put it in a book in the library, which was a statistical abstract of American agriculture in 1928 to 1929, in a chapter on flax, which we don't raise around there. And he thought it would be safe there. And it was for years, until Grace the librarian was weeding out books that had never been taken out by anybody, and she pulled out the statistical abstract, and this letter fell to the floor, and she read it, and she thought, surely this cannot be my brother-in-law Eugene. And she took it to her sister, and her sister read the letter, and no, the man described here didn't seem to resemble her husband at all. But when she showed it to him, he turned purple, and so he had to be sent off to live with his brother for a while. And his brother thought, what a dope, Eugene. Huh, nobody's ever going to catch me. But then they did. He had a passionate encounter with Amber, the waitress at Moonlight Bay, and they went off, and he said he was going to go play poker, but then he came home at 2 a.m. and he had a big gash over his left eyebrow, And it's so seldom you get hurt playing poker that way. And so he had to tell the truth, which was painful for him. He had been struck by a mirror falling off the ceiling of room 14 at the Romeo Motel, which is up on the access road about 25 miles north of town. And nobody goes there, but he had, with Amber, and they were lying in the jacuzzi and looking up and admiring themselves in the mirror, and he opened a bottle of champagne, and the cork bounced off the mirror, and that cut it loose, and suddenly their reflections started to get bigger and bigger. And glass fell on them, and they were yelling, and alarms going off, and sirens, and six firemen in phosphorescent yellow jackets came bursting through the door, and then when they saw what was going on, then six more came through the door. And there were just two sinners standing there, all dripping wet and with wet sheets around them and bloodstains and broken glass. And he had to go home and face the enormous, enormous silence of his wife. I've told all these stories before. I am a storyteller. My people are not. My people are secret keepers. They don't believe in this. You're lucky to have me because they would not tell you these things. They tell you little moral fables about the advantages of hard work and frugality and adherence to duty and the dictates of conscience. But there's a lot of human nature in all of us, and that's what stories are. Stories are mainly about is about human nature. I don't care what you do. Do what you're going to do. But just tell me about it. Just tell me about it and don't leave anything out. I will find a way to disguise you. I just want to know. Well, let me tell you a story that I... And let me close here with just a little story about first time I was in Philadelphia. And then if there are any questions from this group, we can have a question and answer period, or at least a question period. And you can ask me questions, I'll ask you questions, and we're going to do that. My story. Well, I mean, there's certain stories I don't know you well enough to tell you, but there was a time in my life when I was on the run from everything I was brought up to think was true. I took off after college. I hit the road. I just wanted to get out and see the world, and knowing that I was going to be a writer, I wanted to see parts of the world that were forbidden to me, and I succeeded in part, although some parts forbidden to me, I didn't know where to find them. So that was a problem. But I did make my way down to Chicago, down to Cicero, the rough suburb on the west side of Chicago, and there I fell in with evil companions whom I really deeply enjoyed, And they taught me how to use a deck of cards in a useful manner, so that the odds would be in your favor. We hadn't gone to movies, danced, or played cards at all in my Sanctified Brethren childhood. So this was a discovery for me, and I discovered that I had a real facility to be able to double shuffle, so that the cards that would be useful to you would be accessible to you. Which is very handy if you are involved in games of chance in which large sums of money are involved. I got into a game there in Cicero. Not a good idea, because it's a tough town. It's where Al Capone was from, and there are still people there who knew him. But I got in a game with some men in pinstripe suits, and I won $23,000 in less time than it takes to tell about it. Just unbelievable. There it was. And this was back at a time when $23,000 was about twice the annual salary of anybody who taught me in high school. So, well rewarded. And I also won in the very next hand a 1957 Chevy with wire wheels. Pink and black Chevy with beautiful sort of blonde leather upholstery. Now, when you win a game using techniques, you should leave town right away. But I stayed to have lunch in a cafe called Mom's Cafe. I sat down and I ordered the lunch that I had seen other hustlers order, which was a hamburger, extremely rare, and a slice of raw onion, a quarter inch thick, and hot ground mustard, and a raw egg yolk in a china teacup, and a shot of gin. You toss back the egg yolk, and you chase it with the gin, and I reached into my pocket for a Lucky Strike cigarette, LSMFT, and I smoked my cigarette, and I noticed that a beautiful young woman in a red dress with spaghetti straps was sitting on a stool at the counter, and she was sipping coffee from a cup, and she was studying me very closely. She was so beautiful, I assumed that she was waiting for somebody to come and pick her up, and perhaps was in the business of waiting for somebody to pick her up. But she engaged me in conversation. Her name was Francine. She was gorgeous. She had sort of mahogany colored hair that was tied up in a French roll, kind of a clasp in back. And she was the most beautiful girl I had ever been in conversation with. She asked me my name. I said, my name is Carson Weiler. I'm from Minnesota, but don't hold that against me. I'm a free man, I said. What do you do? She said. I said, I do as little as necessary. I'm on my way out of here. I'm going someplace. I'm going someplace, and as soon as I get there, I know I'll be restless and move on. I'm a gypsy. I'm a rolling stone. She said, I've often thought of being free with somebody. Well, those were words no woman had ever said to me before. I said, Francine, if you're going to be free with me, you'd best make up your mind, because I'm on my way out of here. And I ate that hamburger in about four bites, and I left a $20 bill, an enormous tip, and I was out the door, and I could hear her footsteps following me out to the parking lot. And she got into the 57 Chevy, and she sat there in the front seat, and I got behind the wheel, and we headed off toward the east to go off to richer fields to conquer. Now, this is a time when there was a bench seat in the front seat. This was back before Planned Parenthood brought about the bucket seat and the gear shift in the middle. And as we drove off to the east through Indiana, she slid over toward me, and I put my right arm across the back of the seat, and with the back of my fingers, I lightly caressed her mahogany hair and the clip that held them in place, hoping that I would have the chance to unfasten that clip at some point in the near future. We drove on through Indiana, and the sun went down as we came into Ohio, and she lay her head, her beautiful head, in my lap, and I drove on through the night. This is before the interstate system, so we're just driving highways, heading off towards the mysterious east. She lay her head on my lap, and right about that time was when the water pump started to overheat, and I had to pull into a garage in Sandusky, Ohio, and take it into a garage called Mike's Garage. It was quite late, but he was still open for business. And as he was fixing it, we crossed over the road over to a dance hall called Tumbleweed Romance, in which there was a bare wood floor and a jukebox sitting there with a single light bulb over it. I put all sorts of quarters into it, and I played Hank, and I played Lefty, and I played everything I could think of that sounded like a love song, and we danced close together. We just swayed back and forth with our bodies pressed against each other, and I put my right hand on her bare shoulder, which was very warm, and it was indescribably lovely. I was falling in love with her, and then a man came on the jukebox, and he sang "Este amor de apasionado, ande todo abortado, por volver, voy camino a la locura, y aunque todo me tortura, sé querer, hace tiempo," and I suddenly knew that I was in love now, and there was no way not to be. We got back into the 57 Chevy, and we drove on towards the east across Ohio, and we finally were coming to the Pennsylvania Turnpike, this famous, famous, beautiful road, and the smell of the hills of Pennsylvania was so lovely. We'd just gotten into Pennsylvania when she let out a cry, and she said, "Oh my God," she said, "I've forgotten my lucky lipstick back at that dance hall, my shameless crimson lipstick. We have to turn around and go back and get it. I cannot be without it." I said, "Darling, when we get to Philadelphia, I'll buy you any lipstick you want. I mean, you have no need for a lucky lipstick. You have me now. You, that's all the good luck you can hope for." And, "No," she said, "this is my lucky lipstick. I must have it. We must turn around and go back." I said, "Darling, a man who would turn around and cross Ohio for a stick of lipstick is no longer a free man." "And it was freedom that attracted you to me in the first place, if I'm not mistaken." She said, "Darling, a man who would not go against his own principles for the woman he loves is nobody I could ever be with for 5 minutes. You must turn around or else pull over." And so I pulled over. She opened the door and she got out right there on the turnpike. She got out and I could smell this rich grass and new mown hay, and I could hear all of the bullfrogs in the ditches, and they were all saying, "Go back and get it, go back and get it. Go back and get it." But it was a test of wills, and I thought that she would turn around, but she did not. She walked into my headlight beam, and she walked up the shoulder of the turnpike, and then I heard the air brake of the semi coming up behind me, a high beam on, and he slowed down, and he pulled up, and she climbed up the ladder into his cab, and he pulled away, and right then I knew that I would never ever be so lighthearted ever again in my life. I knew that I now understood what the blues is, the meaning of the blues, which is to want something so badly that you know that you cannot have it because you want it so badly. And the more you want it, the more you'll be unable to ever have it, which in any case, there was no chance of you ever having it in the first place. I drove on to Philadelphia. I had some idea that that was where she was from. I came into the city. I was completely lost. I was exhausted. I was worn out entirely. And I knew it was a mistake, but I pulled into a cafe and saw a group of gentlemen in a back booth who seemed to be interested in games of chance. I could hear dice. I went back and I sat with them, and we had some small talk. And in no time at all, I had lost $23,000 and a 57 Chevy playing baseball poker, which I did not have a good understanding of, as it turns out. I lost everything in this city. All I had left was just the money to buy some lunch. And so I ordered myself a hamburger, extremely rare, and a slice of raw onion, quarter-inch thick, and a raw egg yolk in a china teacup, and a shot of gin. I tossed back the raw egg yolk, and I chased it with a gin, and I reached in for my lucky strike, and there, to my surprise, I found a tube of Shameless Crimson in my pocket. It was sitting right there. And so, every time I come back to Philadelphia, even though...
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.